Hi, everybody. My name is Lou, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, you see, 12 years ago, 1975, November, there was one meeting in Auburn, California. And I came from Southern California, and we were used to a lot of meetings down there, and that wasn't enough for me. And because I'm a pig, I want it all. And so a bunch of us got together, and we decided we would form a group and but stay open. We wanted a place for the new drunks to have a place to go. We got together, and we rented a building out on Canal Street. And so we had 14 chairs, one coffee pot, and a cold water faucet. And we started a meeting, so we said, well, let's do it. I like alcoholics. We had one meeting a night and open in the daytime for drunks to come. So we didn't have to go to bars. And we had an answering service. Well, needless to say, with 14 chairs and about 6 members who were interested, we would sit down there, and we just couldn't hack it by ourselves. And I must say this, if it hadn't been for the Al-Anons, men and women, that come down and answer the phone and help us keep the doors open and make coffee, we just wouldn't have made it. And so it was a group effort there. But some of the Al-Anons got real wise, and they were just supposed to direct the people to the meetings, but they would get bored, and some of them would try to make a 12-step call on some of these sick people. And that wasn't working very good. We had a lot of controversy. I know there's a guy sitting here, but old Dale and I wasn't going to mention name, but Dale and I were the only two people that I can think of that was there every night and every day. And we have tried to keep these 14 chairs full. And it was really difficult, you know. So we were dragging people off of the street and bringing them down there. And I don't know, something happened, and it just started growing. But I love that bunch of people, those little kids that come in there, and not many of them stayed. But we stayed. We stayed. And finally, we got enough money that we got a plumber come in there and made us some hot water. It's a wonder we didn't all die with hoof and mouth disease. And we got another toilet, too. Man, we were uptown. We stayed there about 2.5 years. And finally, we had enough money to buy some chairs. Because this 14 chairs that we had were just old kitchen chairs or anything. You'd get goofed if you sit down in them half of the time. But it was fun. But we got that 50 chairs, we felt very affluent. So we went down to the little green building. Because this was too far for the people that... most of the new people didn't have cars at the time, so they'd have to stagger out to Canal Street without a town. So this little green building that we all loved, I think this is very dear to all of us. Very dear. It was right downtown, so people could fall in down there. They could come from the unemployment office or wherever they were coming. And so here we had a lot of fun. But we filled those chairs up, and about 6.5 years, we stayed there. With a lot of help, with a lot of help. New people came, and we just outgrew the place. We outgrew the place. We would sit in the windows and just anything. We would have potlucks. We would have anything. But this is where we learned how to love. We learned how to love down there. And so finally, though, we outgrew this. And across the street, there was this humongous big church building. This big church building. So the Auburn Fellowship decided to rent that. We rented the church building, and we didn't have to go in there, and we didn't have to wash toilets or anything. It was ready for us to move into. So we moved into this building, and God, we felt good. You know, drive up there in this big church building. And about 2 months, I think, the neighbors, they went to the city hall, and they said, we don't want those kind of people. You know, they didn't want those kind of people in their neighborhood. And that killed us, you know, because we had some school teachers and we would parade the lawyers that we, but it didn't make, those people were going to go. So they took us to City Hall and they wouldn't give us a planning commission. The planning commission wouldn't give us something. And we're down here and I'll tell you one thing we learned. Don't fight City Hall because you're going to lose your ass. So we got our eviction notice from there. We weren't there very long, and it was a pretty building. Pretty building. But then we found our place, our present place. So we were, I guess, about 3 or 4 months. We stayed as long as we could there. And about 3 or 4 months, we found our place, our present location. And it's a perfect place for Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Because those kind of people don't get the people that are around there. Because they just come off of the freight trains. It's right across from the track. It's right across from the track. And we get a lot of them. You know, you try to walk in sometimes over in fellowship, and you fall over sleeping bags and things. But that's all right, too. Some of them stay. But they don't care. They don't care. It has grown so much. The Auburn Fellowship has grown so much. But I will say this, that it's a combined effort. When we got started, if it hadn't been for the Alanos sitting there and giving us, letting us get a little sleep, and I know one poor little old man, he was a husband, and he'd come in and Dell, he was supposed to answer the phone. He's dead now, God love him. But he was an old man, he was about 85 then, he'd come in and go to sleep on the couch. But he was there. He was there. He did his shift every day. But, you know, there was a lot of effort, but there was a lot of sincerity there. And now, the thing that amazes me now, doesn't amaze me really. It really doesn't amaze me. I see these young people. This dinner that these kids put on. This thing that they put on. They take over. This is what it's supposed to do. This is what Alcoholics Anonymous is for. It grows. It grows. And the little gal that I got to say one thing for the little gal that ramrodded this thing tonight, 10 months sobriety, and she did a wonderful job. But she had a lot of help. A lot of help. And we've all had a lot of help. I'm not going to take a lot of time. There was a lot of things that I could say. We get mad and fight each other. But that's another story. And if you want to read the gory part of it, buy the Inquirer. It's all in there, believe me. Who's doing what to who and why. But that's another story. It's exciting. So with that, I'm going to turn it over. Here's Johnny.
Hi, everybody. My name's Johnny Harris, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight, and I'm glad to be sober. You know, there's some new people here tonight, and I hope that word, being sober, doesn't offend you as bad as it offended me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I finally got into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I sit in the back row where new people always sit, and the people of Alcoholics Anonymous talk to me about being sober, I didn't think they had anything to offer me. You see, when I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was as physically sober as I am right now. As physically sober. And that seemed to be the problem. If I could have stayed loaded forever, I'd have never came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I kept getting interrupted out there on my happy road of destiny by people in those little black and white cars saying I was having so much fun, and I didn't know what to do about it. So if you're new here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would only pray one thing for you. I would only pray that you will stay in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to come to understand and feel what we mean when we say sober and sobriety, as opposed to what the rest of the world says about sober and sobriety. You see, I'm extremely pleased to be here tonight, fully clothed and in my right mind. And I tell you that for only one particular reason. A little over 29 years ago, I crawled around on my knees in a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary barking at the moon. And because of a loving God has expressed himself through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and knees like an animal. Now, if I don't get anything out of this deal at all, I could live with that for a long time. It makes me feel good. I would like to be able to stand here tonight and tell you or anybody else who would listen to me for any length of time without any type of reservation whatsoever that that's where alcohol and drugs took me to. Oh, I'd love to be able to tell you that. That's where I took me to. The only thing that alcohol and drugs did in my life, they kept me alive long enough to find Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all. I'm as sure as I'm standing here without alcohol working in my life, I'd have blown my brains out before I was 9 years old. I've always been some type of an emotional misfit. I never seemed to belong anywhere. I never seemed to fit anywhere. I was always restless and irritable and discontent. And I was angry about everything. That's the first thing I remember, is being angry. I don't even know what I was angry about, but I was angry. I didn't like who I was, where I was. I didn't like the people I was around. I didn't like the things I thought. Because, you see, I always knew I was wrong when I thought those things. I knew you weren't supposed to feel the way I felt. No, I had excuses. I had great excuses. God, I had a drunken mother, a drunken father, four drunken uncles, three drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I said, well, no wonder I feel different. I've been born beneath my station. These are bad people. I don't belong around them. So I guess there somewhere I started a search for this journey. But what in my journey through life, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, in this search or this answer that I seemingly had to have, I don't know about anybody else, but it seemed like to me that I have always had to have an answer. I've always had to have some type of an answer, some type of thing, because I was so tormented all the time. I was so confused about what went on in my life. I didn't understand what was going on. I had this family, and they would gather up on the weekends and beat each other half to death. They'd steal each other's whiskey and each other's women, and I guess whoever survived that week was the king for however they worked it out. I don't know how they had that figured out, but he was a charger, I guess. But what was really confusing is long about Wednesday or Thursday, they'd put their arms around one another and say, we love one another because we're family. And I guess, I don't know, I guess that I must have got into my head back there sometime. If that's what love is, you can keep it. I don't need it. Because I don't ever remember in my entire lifetime prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and for a long time after I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, ever being able to say the word love. I never said I loved anybody. You see, people like me don't love anybody. People like me use things. See, I'm an alcoholic. I suffer from a disease called alcoholism, and I'm also characterized about other things. I'm a user, I'm a taker of things, and I'm an abuser of people, so therefore I'm a loser. I'm selfish, and I'm self-centered, and I'm self-seeking. And alcohol just made that bearable for me to live with that type of a torment on me, because I've always known that. I didn't have the words for it. I couldn't put it on my finger and say, that's what I am, and this is what I am. I just didn't know. I just knew that I didn't want to be where I was, around who I was, doing what I was doing, and thinking what I was thinking. I wanted out, so I started looking for a way out. And I looked out. I was the first place I ever went. I went with my grandmother. My grandmother didn't drink alcohol, and she went someplace every Sunday and came back doing all right. She cooked things in the kitchen and sing songs to Jesus. She just had a great time in there while they're killing each other down the hall down there. But Grandma just having a great time. So I thought, well, I'll go where Grandma goes. But I never figured out one simple thing when I went with Grandma. Wherever I went, I went. I don't want you to get too deep, folks, but try to hang on to some of this heavy stuff I'm laying out there for you. I know it may just be a little bit too heavy for you, but try to grasp some of it. You know, I never figured, wherever I went, that rotten attitude went. Wherever I went, what I was, I saw, what I felt, and so I left these people that I felt different and strange and irritable around and hated went way on the other side of town and sat down with another group full of people and felt different and strange and irritable, and I hated all them too. I didn't know what was going on, but there I was. And so I sit there this Sunday morning a long time ago in this church while this man in these long flowing robes and this air of authority stood at a podium and looked down at me and said that I was supposed to love and honor and respect my parents. And I guess what I wanted from this man more than anything else is the same thing I'd wanted all my life from everybody. It's the same thing I always wanted, I suppose. I wanted somebody to tell me what was the matter with me. And even more important than that, I wanted somebody to tell me what to do about what was the matter with me. And this guy told me I was supposed to love these people, and I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for reasons I didn't even understand, and God, I felt guilty about that. That's the first time I remember that long arm of guilt reaching down inside of me and choking my guts because I'm frightened to death that people are going to find out that I was hating when I was supposed to be loving. And I didn't know how to handle it. And so I did a lot of things. I turned to walk outside the door of the church that day, thoroughly convinced. My old man standing there drunk and hungover, and he tapped me on the head and said, "Son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me." I don't know what that did for my old man, but I haven't been back to church since. And it hasn't got anything to do with church. It's got to do with me. I didn't want to be like my old man. I didn't want to be them things. I lived in a house where there were two drunks working. And that's a frightening place for a little kid. In the middle of the night, they're screaming and yelling and cussing and flesh hitting flesh and breaking furniture. And deathly silence. And the silence is what's terrifying. See, they are out there somewhere when there's silence in my house, and they're coming in, and I know they're coming in. And I know what's going to happen when they come in. It's going to start all over. So I lay there and I think about my uncles who live in penitentiaries, my aunts who work in those houses on the other side of the tracks. I think about my old man who beats up my mother, and my mother who beats up my old man. I dream about all that stuff, and so it finally dawns on me what the problem was. It's alcohol. They drink. And they do those things. I'm not going to drink because I'm not going to be like them. I'm going to be better than they are. I'm going to step out into that world. I'm going to have something. I'm going to do something. And I'm going to be something. What do you do if you're weird? I'll tell you what I did. I took a drink. It was a big decision on my part. I got into my old man's bootleg boots and took a drink of alcohol. And what happened to me was, I sold myself into bondage for a feeling, the feeling I got when I drank alcohol. That stuff went down inside of me and it tore all the madness from me. It took me from the black pit of nothingness, stood me into the gray fringes of the business of living, and installed in me some type of arrogance that said, "Damn you, world, it's all right. I'm not good enough to be around the good people, but I'm too good to be around the bad people. It's okay right here." That's what alcohol did for me. If alcohol still did that, I'd still drink it. And the reason I don't drink alcohol or use drugs anymore, they don't work. That's as simple as I know how to tell you. Now, the sad part about my life is they quit working 10 years before I knew they did. I spent the last 10 years of my life running around out there in them city streets trying to find the answer and end up a hypodermic syringe 10 years after I quit working. And in the back of my head was the same thing that always been in the back of my head. Once upon a time, when the insanity had engulfed me and I couldn't stand life anymore, I just took a little drink and everything got all right. Now, you don't give that up easy. You just don't give that up easy. And then people would say to me, "Why do you drink? Why do you drink? How do you explain to somebody? You don't understand, the world's crappy. Everything is bad and bad, bad, and you..." "What's happening, baby?" You don't give that up easy. People want to know why we drink. Well, God, if it did that for him, he'd drink too. But you see, like all false answers, it quit working. And I became willing to do anything there was to do. Face any consequences there was to face. Take anything there was to ask for just that moment that I got when I took a drink. The penalty wasn't severe. The rewards were so much greater. And so I took a drink of alcohol. Now what happened to me during the next 20 years of my life happened to me every time I took a drink of alcohol. Sooner or later. 3 days later, I was pulled out from underneath a bridge and stood in front of a judge and sentenced to the Hutchison State Reform School. 20 years later, I took a drink of alcohol in Compton. They pulled me out of a car and stood me in front of a judge and sentenced me to 20 years in the penitentiary. That's what happened to me when I drank. I got drunk and went places. Travel around. Reform school, the junior penitentiaries, the penitentiaries, the nut houses. All the nut houses. This reminds me of Saturday night in the nut house. It does. I don't. We had dances Saturday night in the nut house. We had to go to group therapy before the dance. They fed us and we had group therapy, then we danced. That's what we did in the nut house on Saturday, very much like the young people do nowadays. I used to wait. I didn't know. But see, at this time in my life, they were teaching me better living through electricity. They used to give me my treatments on Saturday. And this place really reminds me of that dance hall in the nut house for some reason. I think I saw a couple of you there. But I used to lean up against the wall, you know, like most of the hipsters do when we're waiting. Only I didn't have any choice. I either leaned up against the wall or fell down. I just stood there. And pretty soon, here she'd come. She'd been treated. She'd shuffle over there, you know. We'd engage in meaningful conversations. She would say, and I'd go, yeah, all right. Yeah. And she'd finally get it out. She'd say, "What's your name?" And I'd go, It was on my little wristband. I didn't know. Funny, isn't it? It's hilarious. You know, all it would take for me in the very near future, even after 28 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be standing up against the wall in a nut house with my brain gone, and the only recognizable thing that I had would be an armband on my wrist. You know the only thing it would take? Would be a simple thought. I'm different. I don't have to go to that many meetings anymore. I can let the newcomers do it nowadays. I don't really have to do that anymore. And then I could become complacent. If complacency sat in my life, it wouldn't be very long till I'll be leaning up against the wall in a nut house on Saturday night, waiting for the big score to happen. And you know what complacency is, as defined in the dictionary? It says it's a sense of well-being while surrounded by danger. But I know you're not complacent up here in wherever we are. I don't know where I am. I really don't. I just got in the car with some crazy woman today. He told me she's going to take me up to where God was. And I've never known where he was, but I found out we crossed an overpass down here. He says, right on the other side of that overpass. Yeah. See, now you know why I think about the nut house today. Sitting on a furlough from a reform school one day, alcohol quit working in my life. And a guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Why don't you try these?" And he gave me some pills. I don't remember saying to him, "What are those?" "Will they hurt me?" No, I just went. Thank God they weren't X-lax. I could start a whole new program called Laxatives Anonymous or something. I don't know. They were. They drove the insanity out of me. They did whatever they were supposed to do. They made it bearable for me to live in a world I didn't understand for a little while. And I went back to reform school. Came back a little while later and sat on a furlough from another reform school one day. I'm sitting there. I'm eating pills and I'm drinking wine. Nothing's working. And a guy stuck a needle in my arm. And for the next 14 years of my life, I stuck needles in my arm, went in and out of institutions. That's what I did. I lived out in them city streets where people like me live in the streets. I didn't work because I stole. I couldn't make enough money to do the things I did. I did whatever I had to do to survive out there in them streets. And if you've ever lived in them streets, you know what you have to do. I don't have to draw you a diagram of what it's like to survive on them streets. Ain't no place else to go. And it's real easy. If you live out in them streets long enough, you go to jail. There's no big mystery about that. They just come along and say, get in. Get in. You don't say, why? officer, I have some rights. You know, the right I had was my head up against a billy club. You're right. Off to jail I went. But it wasn't all bad. You know, I had it pretty much made, so I thought, in the early 50s, 1949, 1950, somewhere around there. I had everything that society says is you're supposed to have to be successful. I had a big apartment building. I lived in the top floor. I had a closet full of $300 suits. I had a big automobile parked in the garage. I had people come around at all hours of the night, and they begging me for favors, and every once in a while, the big man would grant them a favor. The only problem was I couldn't leave the apartment because every time I did that, they jumped on me and took me to jail. But I used to wander around in the streets along about 5 o'clock in the afternoon in my big automobile or one of my brand new suits. And I'm not too impressed with myself when I'm by myself. And I'm starting downhill now as I look back on. I don't know that. Because now I'm starting to ask myself questions. I'm driving up alongside of people in old beat-up pickup trucks, and I'm saying to myself things like, I wonder why I can't be like that guy. I wonder what's the matter with me. I wonder why I can't be like my brother, why I can't just go to work and have a wife and a couple of kids. Good God, what's the matter with me? I didn't know. I had no way of knowing what was wrong with me. And so I did the only thing I knew how to do when I'd run out of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions to blame for my dilemma. And I had to have something to blame from keeping from blowing my brains out. Blame God for it. It's God's fault. He don't talk back. Listen to it. You hear that in AA all the time. I guess if God wants me to have a job, he'll shoot it down here to the club. Deal. Next time you get hungry, you go lock yourself up in a closet and pray for a hot dog. If God squirts you one through the keyhole, you call me. I'll be on the next plane north. That may happen up here in just this side of that overpass. How do I know? I'll tell you, I have been close to and active in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous for a little over 28 years now. And I've only learned one simple thing about God. I'm not a spiritual giant. And I'm not one of them real. I only know one thing about God. I know that God will not do anything for me that I can do for myself. Nothing. And there's only been one single thing in my entire life I have never been able to do. I wasn't able to do it before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't been able to do it since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I won't be able to do it from tomorrow or tonight on. Of myself and by myself, I cannot keep from taking a drink. I can't do that. Now, for over 28 years and 1 month of my life, I haven't taken a drink, swallowed anything, smoked anything, or stuck anything in my arm. And what even blows my mind more than that is, I haven't had a conscious thought or a conscious desire to put any of that stuff in my system from the first moment I laid eyes on you to this instant. And that doesn't make me miraculous or wonderful. It just seems that God seems to know in my life that I can't harbor a thought in my head for over 30 seconds without putting it into action. That's how sick I am. So therefore, I spend most of my waking moments trying not to think. If I could do one thing in life, I'd destroy every sign I've ever saw that says think, think, think. Yeah, I'll tell you, we were talking about it before the meeting tonight. A guy was talking to me about meditation. I said, I don't do that. He said, why not? I said, every time I start to meditate, I associate with lower companions. Me. It could bring me back up into my mind. I'm dangerous. I just think. Oh, God. I was a long way from Alcoholics Anonymous in 1951 when I was captured and sent to the penitentiary for the first time. I stood in the old Los Angeles County Jail on my way to the penitentiary. My mother showed up at a visiting screen and screamed at me through the visiting screen that I was a murderer. It seemed that my 17-year-old brother had gotten into some of my poison and took an overdose of it and died. I didn't know how to handle it. I didn't know how to handle it because I knew I was supposed to feel something. I knew I was supposed to think something and do something or have some concern, but I had none. I had no conscious thought about things. I was so worried about me. I stood handcuffed between two detectives 3 days later while they buried the only thing in my life that I ever cared anything about, my baby brother. And I stood there with all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging around my shoulders, and I would have liked to have cried, but I didn't know how. I didn't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth. The reason I didn't have them, because I didn't think they were necessary. I spent the next 4.5 years of my life in a penitentiary. I came out of there 4.5 years sicker than I was when I went in there. I spent the next couple of years of my life trying to prove what a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me wasn't true. He told me that people like me didn't change. He told me I was doomed to die in an institution. He took me down and showed me a little green room. He says, you're going to end up here, hot shot. And I told him, not me, I'm different. If I'm off now, that institution bound determined, I had that deal beaten 6 months later, I'm laying in a nut house kicking and screaming. And that's when I made my round of some of the better laughing academies in the country, interviewing psychiatrists. Well, I used to sit there with my wraparound overcoat on and talk to them. They talked to me about my mother, and I talked to them about their mother. And that's when they introduced me to better living through electricity. They said I had a bad attitude. Well, let me tell you something. If on Saturday they shocked you senseless for 3 days, and you start coming to about Tuesday, and you realize what they've done to you, your attitude won't be too good either. You realize that for 3 days of your life, you've been wandering around bumping into things, trying to figure out what that name tag said. Your attitude won't be very bad. And you see, I guess they meant right. I guess they would, what they used to always put into my folders were that they were trying to break me. They were trying to break my spirit, they'd say, or kill this arrogance in me, or whatever it was they were trying to do. And they were trying to do it through humiliation. You can't break people like me through humiliation. You make me angry. You humiliate me, you make me angry. And I'm going to retaliate. See? I didn't know. They tried, and they tried. They did everything. They humiliated me. They let me out of a nut house. And 30 years ago right now was real bad. 30 years ago, I was running around out there in the streets doing exactly what I wanted to do whenever I wanted to do it, for as long as I wanted to do it. And 30 years ago, come next month, they tied me down in the bed in the old Los Angeles County Jail, more dead than alive. I weighed 128 pounds, and I was the color of that piece of paper on that door over there. And a medical doctor stood at the foot of my bed and told me I was going to die. This was his statement. He said, son, you're going to die, and nothing we can do for you. I said, okay. He left, and all day passed, and all night passed. He come wandering into my room the next morning. He looked at me, and he said, son, you're going to die, and nothing we can do for you. I said, okay. The third day he came into my room, I had a terror grip me that I've never known before or since. The idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. was going to have to get up out of that bed, go to the penitentiary, and come back out and start that rat race all over again. I didn't want to do that. I laid in that bed for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I'd ever said in my life. I said, "Oh, God, help me." I thought for a long, long time nothing had happened, because there was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts. And we got an AA meeting down there. A little bird didn't drop the fifth chapter on my chest. I just went to sleep for a little while. I tell you how sick I was. 2 weeks. 2 weeks. After I'd screamed out that prayer in my deathbed, I'm up running around the jail looking for some more of the poison to put me back on the bed I'd just gotten off of. And the reason I'm doing that, I believe, is because it couldn't stand me. I couldn't turn off the nightmares. I couldn't get rid of the pictures. I couldn't get rid of the faces of the thing I'd do. I couldn't get rid of that craziness that was inside of me that was driving me nuts. And in the back of my mind, is that once upon a time, I used to drink something, swallow something, or shoot something, and that insanity went away for a little while. Even though it hasn't done it for a long, long time, I know that it'll work if I can just find the right combinations. I stood in front of a Superior Court judge and was called a blood-sucking parasite of society. That man told me that I wasn't fit to live around decent people. Told a woman who was carrying my child that she cared anything about that child that I'd never be allowed to lay eyes on him. He didn't tell me anything I didn't know. But my attitude was, it's not me he's talking about. That's my old man or my uncle or somebody. But you see, even anybody that's as selfish and as self-centered as I am, and is completely and totally engrossed in my own denial as I was, the truth still penetrated that armor of ignorance of mine to the fact that I knew for the first time in my life exactly what I was. I had never heard it said before, but I always knew the description. You see, nobody's ever had to judge me. Nobody ever has to judge you. I knew what I was. I have always known what I was. I know what I am as I stand right here tonight. Nobody has to judge me about that. I'm my own worst judge, my own worst jury, and my own worst critic. You see, I judged me when I was 6 or 7 or 8 years old and condemned me to death. That's what I did. Because I knew that alcohol would kill me. Sooner or later, I knew that. But I didn't know that. I didn't know I'd done that because I didn't openly say, "You're guilty, you're going to die." I just didn't know that. The evidence of that man's statement was so damning, I spent the next 9 months of my life crawling around on my knees, barking at the moon up there in San Quentin. And on the first Sunday in November 1959, to no great efforts of my own, I stumbled into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't take any credit for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't even take any credit for staying here from that day to this day. If I'd have known where I was coming, I wouldn't even have come. I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what I was. The reason I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was because the institution I was in allowed women to come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous over 28 years ago to smell perfume. And I've been honking and sniffing around her ever since. I never will forget my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I pray God, I never forget. I moved in and I sit down in the back row, what I lovingly like to call my throne of contempt. I had my coat collar up and my shades on because I was cool. If I'd have been any cooler when I got here, I'd have probably froze to death, for God's sake. I remember looking up on the backboard. I saw two big gates, and I thought to myself, "My God, I've wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade." I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I said to this clown sitting next to me, "What is this?" He says, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be hanging out with them winos. If it'd been Gangsters Anonymous or Over Hip Anonymous or Ringtail Baboons Anonymous, any kind, I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I didn't want to be one. I thought, well, I'll wait for these women to tell their racy stories. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there weren't any young girls or young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was young then. And these gals got up to talk, these little gals got up to talk, and they said they'd drank a long time. You could look at them and know they'd been somewhere for a long time. There wasn't any doubt about it. They had every drink they took, they had. It was there. But there was something about those people who came, who drove 185 miles up that old back road to that penitentiary to spend 2 hours talking about Alcoholics Anonymous to a bunch of convicts who didn't want to hear them, who were only there to be entertained or wait for the dance to start or whatever we were doing. I don't know what we were doing on Sundays. There's something about them. I saw it tonight here. I saw the same thing. Not in all of you. All of you don't have it. Any gathering of Alcoholics Anonymous, you never. There's only a few people who have it. I saw it as I was sitting there watching people in line. I was watching people standing in line going up there to get the food. Some of them have scowls on their faces. Some of them look like they would crack if they smiled. Some of them have just a shuffling of, I don't want to be here. Let's get this over and get on to something else. And then there was another group of people wandering around who seemed to be walking kind of light and easy and dancing and having fun and doing it. And I kind of noticed these people. These were the people who had been setting up the meetings and who had been working in the kitchen and who had been doing all the things to set this thing up. These are the givers in Alcoholics Anonymous who were doing these things. They seemed to have this lightness and this freedom and this air about them that I'm not saying that everybody in that line had that, but I noticed the difference in it. I look for that anymore. I look to see who is in Alcoholics Anonymous and who's just here for a cup of coffee. It just seems to be one of the things I do anymore. I don't know. It's not a matter of judgment. It's just as obvious as looking at that door over there. You know who you are. I don't have to tell you. You know who you are, who's happy, and who knows who's just killing time till the dance starts. I mean, sometimes I feel like that. Sometimes I feel like when I come to a dinner and a meeting and a dance that I'm just the fill-in between the meal and the dance, for God's sake. I mean, the dance and the social structure shouldn't be the most important thing in an AA meeting. In an AA function, the AA meeting should be the most important thing. Not the meal, not the dance, not the social activities, not who you're going to catch or be with this weekend. I mean, I don't judge. I just observe and report the facts. I mean, I didn't know that when I said at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I left my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You run me out of my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You talked to me about God. When I came in, you talked to me about God. I got up and left and got, because God was the reason I was. I came back. I don't know why I came back. I guess I came back because I saw these people. And seeing these people, I've seen a miracle. I didn't know that either. I didn't have the slightest idea what was going on. I sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous long enough one day that a guy came in that I knew did 23 flat years in the penitentiary, stood at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous very much like this and told me something I've never forgotten. It makes more sense to me than anything that I know. It'll make more sense to me tomorrow than anything I'll ever learn. He looked down where I was sitting and told me I didn't have to live that way anymore if I didn't want to. He said, you don't have to do it like this no more. And nobody had ever told me that. They'd been telling me all my life not drink, swallow, smoke, and chew, but they didn't tell me how to live without doing it. Nobody knew. I went up to this guy after the meeting. I said, how do you learn how to live? He told me about a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, Johnny, you go home and get that book, and I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in it. I guess he's prayed real hard, that little fella, because I've been a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day. And the only thing I've ever found in that book is me. I haven't looked for anything else. I'm not looking for a way to sober up the world or cure all of society's ills. I'm looking for a way to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and the loving God that made me. There is a strange phenomena that takes place in my life. And I'd like to share that with you. It seems like to me that the closer I adhere to the principles that are written in this book, and the more willing I become to share that knowledge in this fellowship, just for the sheer joy of doing it, the more peaceful and the more comfortable and the more joyous I live with me and the loving God that made me. Now, I had a lot of trouble when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I wasn't an alcoholic. I didn't know what one was, but I wasn't one. And so I'd sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd hear you talk. And you talked, and you proved to me that I wasn't. You'd say things from podiums like this: I used to drink. Now I don't drink anymore, and everything is wonderful. I'd say, I'm not alcoholic then. I'm not drinking either, and I'm crazy. I didn't know what was going on. And then people would say to me, you got to get active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got active. I got run around like a chick with my head cut off. I picked up coffee cups and ashtrays and smiled at people. You know how you do. It's wonderful. Yeah, glad you. And I went back there and sit in the corner, inventory point, and died. I was doing everything you told me to do, and I'm crazy, and nothing happened. So I would say to myself the only logical thing that people like me could say: I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just not an alcoholic. If I was an alcoholic, all I would have to do is not drink and pick up these damned ashtrays, and I'd be wonderful. But I'm not alcoholic, because I'm doing this, and I'm crazy. They're doing it, and they look like they got it together. And every time I talk to one of you, would say, it's in the book. What's in the book? Well, it's there if you just go look for it. You ever notice how they never tell you nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous? You see, there it is. There what is? Well, it's there, and they never finish the sentences. They never finish it. Everybody talks, nobody listens. And they never finish the sentence. That's why they keep telling you newcomers to keep coming back. So maybe you'll get the end of the sentence sometime. I don't know what day you come back. I don't know. The thing that saved my life and made my life what it is and has been all these years is that somewhere in the line, I guess, because I went to a program of recovery outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the same program of recovery that's in this book. Just to let you know that it doesn't happen in a different location. It's the same preamble of the fifth chapter that the man read, and I said how it works. I couldn't admit that I was an alcoholic. I couldn't admit that my life was unmanageable. I couldn't come to believe there was a power greater than myself. I didn't think I was insane. I did do one simple thing, though, I couldn't talk about it. I wrote out an inventory. And I was dangerous when I wrote my inventory. I was ready to cut my throat because everything that I knew was just head knowledge up here became truth when I put it on that paper. It became a fact when I wrote it out. I knew all those things about me, but they were facts when I put it down. I sit down in a man's room, and I spent 3.5 hours talking to him about every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life. And somewhere in that 3.5 hours, I heard myself admit to this man that I was an alcoholic. And with the admission of that statement to this very instant, there had been a freedom inside of me that is hard to describe unless you're free. You would never understand what I'm talking about. You see, I know what's wrong with me now. I never knew prior to that statement what was wrong with me. You see, I'm an alcoholic. Prior to that, I was many things and. But after that statement, I just became a simple alcoholic. And with the admission of that statement, you see, I knew that I had always been restless and irritable and discontent. I didn't know that that was symptoms of my illness. I didn't know that at all. I didn't know I suffered from a disease called alcoholism. I thought I suffered from alcohol. I thought I suffered from drugs. I didn't know I suffered from a disease that was selfish and self-centered and destroying and possessive. Gets worse, never better. I didn't know that. This book, Alcoholics Anonymous, taught me about that. This book, Alcoholics Anonymous, taught me that there is this whole chapter called There Is a Solution. There is a solution. It said that people like me, seemingly me, the outcast and the dredges of the world, will learn to walk in the sunshine of the Spirit. But isn't that fantastic for people who lived in the cold all their life to be warmed by the sunshine of the Spirit? Isn't that a fantastic statement to make to somebody? Some little mole sitting over there in the corner somewhere who has been frightened and cold and lonely all of his life to say you will be warmed by the sunlight of the Spirit? That you will know peace? That you will come to have faith in God and in your fellows? that your life will take on a whole new meaning, and problems that seemingly used to baffle you will no longer baffle you. They become intuitive. You will intuitively know how to do things that seemingly used to baffle you. This book says that I will have some type of a spiritual awakening. As a result of doing certain things, I will have a spiritual awakening. It's a promise. Having had spiritual awakening. That's past tense of having done something. And I know many people in Alcoholics Anonymous seem to think that Bill Wilson had a sudden, spectacular upheaval. If they would read beyond that, they would find out that Bill Wilson essentially worked the first 9 steps of our program of recovery before they were written, and then he had his spiritual experience. He didn't have it first and then do it. He did it first, and then he had it. And the sudden spectacular upheaval didn't happen to me. What happened to me is a spiritual awakening happened like it talks about in the book. It's a gradual thing. A sudden spiritual awakening, as outlined in a dictionary, says it's a higher plane of thinking. And that's all. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, nobody thought lower than I did. Man, I thought about everything. I thought everybody was corrupt. I thought everybody wanted something. Everybody wanted a piece of my action. Of course, I never thought about you. Thought about me. And little by little, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my vocabulary consisted of about 4 four-letter words. Mother ran all around in there somewhere. It's like the trigger that made it all go. And people of Alcoholics Anonymous sent me in rooms and word by word, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, fed me the English language. They told me things like cussing was a crutch for conversational cripples. And then they stood my wrath when they rained on them, and I rained on them. But you see, I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. And I loved these people, even though I didn't know it. And they took time out of their busy lives to correct me. They were more concerned with saving my life than they weren't hurting my feelings. And that's a fantastic quality. If you find anybody like that, you better spend an awful lot of time around them. I come to understand why these people were more concerned with saving my life than when they were hurting my feelings. You see, these people weren't really trying to get a one-upsmanship on me. They weren't really trying to build up any good time so I would overlook their shortcomings. So we weren't overlooking and making allowances for one another. We were just trying to help one another stay sober. And a little over 26 and a half years ago, they opened up the door of that penitentiary and turned me loose in a world I didn't know anything about. On the fourth day in June, 1961, they opened up the doors of the penitentiaries, let me out into a world I didn't know anything about. I was 30 years old, and I had never operated in that world one day in my life since I was 7 years old without some type of a chemical additive in my system. I had never worked a day in my life. I had never done anything. I was a user and a taker. I lived off of people, places, things, circumstances, conditions. I stole and used every single person who come in contact with me. I used them all up. And yet they turned me loose in a world that I didn't know anything about. I went home to see my mother. She fell off the steps blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on a couch, said, "Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting." She said, "Fine, I think you should." I'm very proud tonight to tell you when my mother's sober, she goes to meetings. But my mother doesn't stay sober. But that really isn't any of my business. I learned the greatest lesson in life from my little mother. I learned that I do not have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk either. I don't even have any power to keep me sober. I don't have any power. Where would I get any power? Didn't have any one of God here. I won't have any tomorrow. I don't have any right now. I've got right now. This is all I got. My sponsor used to tell me, "Man, this is a right now program, Johnny. This is what you got right now. Now. You better grab this thing and hang on to it because it may be the only shot you get. Right now." My wife came back and brought this little girl I was never supposed to see, and I thought I ought to go to work. I didn't think I ought to go to work. My sponsor thought I ought to go to work. He said, "You ought to go to work." And I said, "What?" He said, "Work, W-O-R-K, work." You see how they had to talk to me in great intellectual conversations? I'm so smart. My keen alcoholic mind could not comprehend the word worked. You ever never seem to notice that the only people who talk about the keen alcoholic mind are alcoholics? You ever kind of think that? Ask the non-alcoholic about our keen alcoholic mind. Oh, yeah, you mean that guy over there chewing his tongue in two because he's so smart? Really? And then we say, we're not egotistical. I went down to go to work. My sponsor got me a job working in the oil field. I went down to go to work, and I showed up there to work. And the guy said, what's your Social Security card number, kid? And I said, what? He said, your Social Security card number. And I said, what's that? He says, you don't have a Social Security card? And I said, no. He said, how old are you? And I said, I'm 30. He says, you don't have a Social Security card? And I said, no. He said, why not? And I said, I've never needed one. He said, where have you been all these years? I said, you wouldn't understand if I told you, mister. You know what he did? He took me down and got me a Social Security card and put me to work. I couldn't go back and tell my sponsor they weren't hiring ex-convicts. I wanted to. Oh, I wanted to go back and tell him, can I go down and sign up for welfare now? They won't hire ex-convicts. I had to go to work. And then when I went to work, I used to stand off at the side of the liquor store to see what they do when they get paid. You know what they do when they get paid? They go home and they get the wife and the kids and they go to the market and they put them kids in those baskets backwards. And they run them up and down the aisles in the markets, pull the stuff up. And I'd been watching them for that a long time. I finally got a paycheck. I ran home. My wife was there. I said, let's go to the market. She said, what for? I said, that's what they do when they get paid. She said, who? And I said, them. And I must have had one of them spiritual looks about me because she loaded up the kid. We got in the car and went to the market. And I mean, we got home, somebody stole her purse. You want to hear somebody scream? Listen to a thief when they get stolen from. Well, yeah, nobody's as indignant as us. If I could have caught that guy, you'd have another talker here tonight. I'd be over there in Folsom telling you, don't work, that AA. I finally got all through. She poured me a cup of coffee. She said, you through? And I said, yeah. She said, now you know how it feels. You know, I went back to work that afternoon. I got another paycheck 2 weeks later, and I've been getting paychecks for over 26 years now. It's amazing, isn't it? Another little girl was born to that marriage. My fifth or sixth year of sobriety, all hell broke loose. But I became real enraptured with things of the material and things of the spirit. I forgot more important to impress them out there than it was to be with you in here. I had my values all screwed up. I thought cars, money, and property and prestige were the things that were the thing to have. I was working 14, 16, 18 hours a day, and I'd come home from work, and my wife would be gone, and the kids would be gone. I'd go out to find the kids, and I'd put them in the car, and then go find her. She'd be in a bar drinking somewhere. I didn't know what was going on. I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. People say, you're doing just fine. You want to go have an ice cream sundae after the meeting? That's wonderful. Look at my, come on, show you my car. That's how things are going. You see my new sweater I'm wearing? It's all surface crap. I'm covering up the. One day I told this woman that I was married to I couldn't take this thing anymore because I almost went with her to a bar one night and she wanted to go dancing. And the very next morning she took her own life. I didn't handle it very well. I got mad at it. Sat around in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time, angry, hostile, wondering when I was going to get mine, wondering why all this stuff was happening to me because I was active in AA. I'm doing everything in AA. Why do I get all the crap when these guys come in here 90 days ago and that somebody just gave them the universe? I didn't understand. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one night, and my sponsor cornered me and told me that he gives big crosses to big hosses and gives little crosses to guys named John. And I went home that night and tried to figure out how big my cross was, and I didn't have one, because I'd been sober. And oh yeah, there'd been a few days cloudiness in my life in that 5 or 6 years, but most of it the sun's been shining warmly, and I've been bathed in the sunlight of the Spirit. I've been sober. I've been living in a world I don't understand for over 6 years now. I got 2 little kids, and I got a job, and I got a car, and I got a place to live, and I got meetings and friends to go to, and things of that nature. So I got out on my hands and knees, and I said a little prayer, and that prayer is this: God, relieve me from the bondage of self, that I may be witness to those who see of your undying mercy and love. Amen. And I got up, and it seemed like to me I'd been walking toward the sunlight ever since. I've been standing out there in the sunlight of the Spirit on the sunny side of the streets ever since. Because my life has been better and better and better and better. Oh, there have been a few things. The last 4 or 5 years haven't been too swift. My youngest daughter, the idol of my life, the one I love more than anything, is much like me, seemed to have a problem with her nose. Wasn't anything wrong with it. It's just something she was putting in it. And then she swallowed it down with that good Jack Daniels whiskey. But of course she controlled it for quite a while. And I want to report, I'm happy to report to you tonight. That Thursday night, I took my daughter to a meeting with me. She's 26 days sober. But I also have to hasten to tell you that 3 years ago, she was 9 months sober. And she was different. She was too young. She could control it. She'd been an Alcoholics Anonymous. She'd never seen me drink. She'd never known anything but you, an Alcoholics Anonymous in her home. But I tell you, when she's sober and we ride together, my heart just sings. Just sings. The last 4 or 5 years, I've had business failures. 3 years ago, I went through a divorce. I wasn't very happy. Kind of sad of the long-range divorce. It just seemed to be the thing to do at that time. Time to time during this period of my life, there was so much pain in my life that I couldn't sleep. There was so much pain in my life, and I'd sit down and I'd try to pray. I couldn't pray. I hear people say things all the time: pray, turn it over. Right. You ever try to turn it over when you want to turn it over? You can't do it. I sit there so full of pain at night. I couldn't sleep. I'd be on my knees, full of guilt and stuff that I didn't understand. And you know what gave me peace? I would think about some of you. I would think about some of the people that I had known in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd watch some of the power that came into their life, and I would get some hope that if there would be a power in your life, the power must be in my life because I was hanging awful close to you. And I should be closer to you because that's where the power is. I've heard people say all kinds of things, silly things like how they have found God now and they can wander off. I'm going to tell you something that I know. All my life, I was born with the spark of God in me. I know that. Every human being that's born upon the face of this earth is born with the spark of God in them. Everybody. That little spark never leaves. That little spark is always within us. But I'm going to tell you something. I had that little spark of God in me when I'm out there running the streets. When I'm using and abusing and taking, I had as much of a spark of God in me as I got in me tonight. Always the same one. That little spark and me are not enough to overcome the insanity of my illness called alcoholism and the overpowering of my selfish, self-centered thinking. That little spark is not enough. It was only when I infused my little spark with your little spark that there became enough of a power there for me to overcome one day at a time this madness that seemingly engulfs me and gets worse and never gets better. that's called alcoholism. I would be absolutely and totally gone. Dance starts pretty quick. Welcome. We've already taken up the collection, too. I mean, you may think it's cute. I don't. You may miss something. It may kill me. The Alcoholics Anonymous happens to be my life. It's the thing that gave me life. It didn't restore me to anything. I was nothing when I came here. I suffered from a terrible, crippling, killer illness called alcoholism. It's not a happy, wonderful thing that I just happened to pick up because I drank a beer once in a while or swallowed one of my mother's Valium tablets. This thing almost killed me. And it killed my friends and my family all around me all the time. So I take it very seriously. I don't take me too seriously. But I take this program very seriously. And I get offended by people who don't. Because they may kill the people around them, even if they don't take it too serious. That's what offends me. Not you. I'm not offended at you. I'm not offended at anybody. I know that everybody in the world is doing the best they can. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to be taught by the people who went before me just what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. They told me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you don't like it here, get the hell out of here. Don't come around and bother us because we're about the business of living. We're not about the business of dying. If you want to execute yourself, that's your business. But don't come around and do it to us. Some of us want to get there, and some of us don't. And I really don't know about all this other stuff. I hear people talk about all this stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have the slightest idea what they're talking about sometimes. I hear them talking about love and God and all these other kind of things and how they used to love this and love that and how they were full of God once and they're not anymore and now they are again and on and on and on. I know how they love their family. I do not make those statements. I don't understand them statements. I never have understood them statements. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was nobody in my life but me. There never had been. There was no room in my life for nobody else. There was no room in my life for love for anybody. I was only concerned about the rotten deals that I got when I was a kid. I was concerned about the rotten deals that I got all my life, about the drinking. That's all I concerned about with me. I didn't know anything about God. I didn't know anything about anything. And yet when I think about you, I think about God. Isn't that amazing? When I know that there's you, then I know there's God. We're all God's children, all of us are. There ain't any of us special. We're not special. I think that's an ego trip. None of us are special. We're all God's children. If one of us is, we all are. If one of us ain't, none of us ain't. That's as simple as I know how to tell you. There was an old man who told me that, an old man I loved like a father. It was the only father I've ever known, told me that, taught me that very seriously. He said that rain falls on the just as well as the unjust. Then I would ask him questions like, well, then how come I'm sober when there's people that I know who are far better people than I'll ever be aren't sober? How come? He would just smile at me and say, it's because you've come to understand that you're one of God's children and they don't know it yet. And so it's become my primary purpose from that day to this day to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And I don't ever know who's suffering. It might be the oldest member here. It may be the newest member here. It may be somebody in between. I don't know. I really don't know. It's, I was telling Lou, you just throw it out there and let the seeds fall where they fall. I don't know who this drunk is. I really don't know. There's only one thing that I really do know. That I'm a very happy, contented man. That I've spent all day long today not wanting to be anybody else. Not wanting to be anybody else. And that in itself is a miracle. That in itself. Me not to want anything today for myself at all. I don't want anything today for myself at all. I haven't wanted anything all day long. I just wanted to come up here and sit and be with old friends and be with you. That's all. Just come and ride along and do the thing that I'm supposed to do. It's miraculous. Because I don't remember. But there have been many days in my life since I've been around you that that's possible. And there was a fellow that I sponsored who gave me a statement. It's the greatest truism that I know. Matter of fact, it's the greatest truism that I have ever heard. It's something that I know to be an absolute and total fact. The only problem with this guy is that he gave me the statement, but he forgot it. Because he changed his actions. He told me one day that if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to keep getting what you're getting. I know that's a little heavy, but try to grasp it as best you can. Kind of deep. That means what it says. There's no hidden psychological evaluations or interpretations about that whatsoever. That means exactly what it says. That means that if you're sitting in this meeting, or you're here tonight, and you don't want to be here, or you're just marking time, and there's misery all about you, or you ain't found something, you're restless, and you're irritable, and you're discontent, just keep on doing what you're doing. You're going to keep on getting what you're getting. But by the same token, if you're sitting in this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, and there's a quietness in your heart, and there's some peace about you, and you are where you want to be, doing what you want to do, then you keep on doing what you're doing, and you'll surely be getting what you're getting. Now, I don't know about anybody else. I really don't. I do not live inside of anybody else's skin. I know nothing about another human being who lives upon the face of this earth. But I can tell you that for me, and only for me, I'm going to continue doing what I've been doing, because I sure do like what I've been getting. Thank you.